about the end time event. We've been talking about the wrath of God. We've been dealing with the last of three questions that the first New Testament church asked Jesus on the Temple Mount. It's a question that involves the wrath of God. And so I'm going to try and deal with that this morning, but I think I'm going to turn this down just a little. For those of you that are listening on the tape, I'm walking back up on the stage, because I'm afraid if I leave that as high as it is, it may have a little ting-a-ling-a-ling in it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. All good children go to heaven. When they get there, they will yell, "Sister Barnes went to Yale County Fair." Now, that sounds just about right. They asked me at these churches, they said, "Who's this Sister Barnes? Is she as mean as you say?" I said, "Oh, she's much worse." And they want to know who this Anna Mae is. They want to know, "Who is this Anna Mae Seals? Is she for real?" And I said, "Yeah, she's for real." And they said, "Cooney." They said, "What kind of a name is that?" I said, "Well, you'd have to know her. But you all get on all the tapes." Actually, the wrath of God is the answer to the third question that the disciples asked Jesus on the Temple Mount. Tonight's the Lord's Supper, and I'm going to talk about the Lord's Supper and show you some things about the last Lord's Supper that I think you'll find interesting. After 25 years here, I have to be honest and tell you that I always preach about the Lord's Supper on the night we take it, but after 25 years, it's hard to find any new material on it. And this isn't new material, but nevertheless, I think you'll enjoy it. I mean, I haven't made it up yet. I'm going to make it up this afternoon, so it'll be kind of a review of a lot of things. For those of you listening on the tape, we're looking at a model of what Herod's temple looked like during the time of Jesus' earthly ministry. And we're going to be talking about three questions that the first New Testament church asked Jesus when he made a very shocking statement to them. This temple, Herod's temple, had been one of the most exciting and precious things in the life of Jesus and all of those disciples that were the first New Testament church. As a matter of fact, every one of them had been required after a certain age to come down to Jerusalem for three feasts during the year: the Feast of Pentecost, the Feast of Passover, and the Feast of Tabernacles. So Jesus had met many times on this Temple Mount. Sometimes they'd meet as a local church over here. Sometimes they'd meet as a local church over here. Sometimes over here. And they worshiped God as a local church standing on the Temple Mount. They were local. They were visible. They were all baptized by the same man, John the Baptist, by the same authority. And they worshiped together as a true local New Testament church that was later, as a church, to be empowered at Pentecost. But this was very dear to them, this building. It was a central focus of their whole worship. Now, they had no idea that the Lord was going to change the system of worship the way he did, that after his demise and ascension into heaven, he would establish all over this earth many more New Testament churches just like them. And each one would be a local, visible, holy temple of scripturally baptized believers coveted together to carry out the Great Commission, and each one of those local visible churches would be a holy temple unto the Lord. So when Jesus made this statement he made about these stones of the temple, he told them that all the stones above this green line, that was known as the temple, the whole upper portion, this was also known as the temple, but this whole portion above this green line was technically called the temple. He said all those huge stones above that green line, huge Herodian ashlars and the small stones, all of them, were going to be leveled. Well, this actually stunned them. I mean, it was the most shocking thing, in their opinion, Jesus had said. It just stunned them to the depths of their soul. Now, bear in mind, throughout his earthly ministry, at any given moment, the disciples, the first New Testament church, had expected Jesus at any moment to proclaim himself King, the Messiah, and to bring in the kingdom that they had so long awaited. And they actually thought that he was going to bring himself in as king, and all the promises that he made them concerning them ruling and reigning with him, sitting on 12 thrones, judging the tribes of Israel, 12 tribes of Israel, they actually thought he was going to do it right then, right there in their lifetime. They didn't understand this glorified body business. They didn't understand it. And they actually thought he was going to bring in the kingdom. So when he made this statement about the temple being destroyed, that just knocked a hole in their minds. And they began to furiously ask him three questions that are indirectly and directly related. So let's take a look at this Olivet Discourse, and let's approach it in the perspective of what we're talking about, the wrath of God. The three questions of the Olivet Discourse. Now, the Olivet Discourse is written in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And I'm going to begin discussing the Olivet Discourse, Lord willing, next Sunday morning. The three questions of the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24, 1 through 3. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. In Luke, we're told they bragged on it. What a beautiful, magnificent building it was. You have to look in all three discourses in order to get the full picture. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Sure enough, they were all thrown down and filled up the Tyropian Valley and filled up the Hinnom Valley to a depth of about 75 feet. And they're just now unearthing many of those huge Herodian ice lars. They've already unearthed many. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, so here he is on the Mount of Olives. He's looking across the Kidron Valley. He's looking down on this same temple mound that he's discussing. The disciples, this was his first New Testament church. They were all baptized by the proper authority. Jesus himself was baptized by that same authority. And they were all traveling together as a local, visible assembly of scripturally baptized believers that were there to carry out and be about their Father's business. So the first New Testament church, the disciples came unto him privately saying, there weren't any lost people there. There weren't any people there who were saved but not baptized. Saying, tell us, and here are the three questions. When shall these things be? Well, just think about it. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. You don't have to be a student of the Greek language. What's the first thing they're going to ask him about? What he has just stated that stunned them down to their socks. He said, tell us. They said, tell us, when shall these things be? They're saying, Lord, when are these stones going to be thrown down, and when is the Temple Mount going to be leveled? But since they had expected him to bring in the kingdom and for him to declare himself as King Messiah, they wondered how all this fit in, the temple destruction, with him proclaiming himself as king. So the second thing they asked him about was what they had been curious about during his entire earthly ministry. And what shall be the sign of thy coming? In other words, how can we know? Is there something you can tell us that will let us know that your coming is at our very doors, that your coming is nigh, that our redemption is drawing nigh? And he answered this question. He also answered the first question. Now the last question that we're dealing with is the question that has to do with the wrath of God. So naturally they were interested in when the temple was going to be destroyed, something they could know and look for to know that Christ's coming and proclamation as king was imminent or very close. And the third thing was, what is going to be the end of this age? How are you going to destroy all these kingdoms on the earth? How are you going to get rid of the Roman Empire? How's all that going to happen? And at the end of the world, and the word world is ion, and it actually means the end of the age. When is this dispensation of time coming in? When is this period going to stop and your millennial reign as king begin? So these were the three questions they asked, and he answered every one of them. Question number one, when shall these things be? When will this temple be leveled? In verses 4, 5, and 6, he answered that question. He answered it very clearly and very specifically and told them that many false Christs were going to show up. Matter of fact, there were quite a few false Christs before he came, when he was here, and even after his demise. He also told them how the Roman Empire was going to break up in verses 4, 5, and 6, and that there would be wars and rumors of wars, but he said, don't be troubled. He said, the end is not yet. Talking about this, the end is not yet. So he told them first about the breakup of the Roman Empire, and the rebellion that the Jews had was a part of that rebellion, which was all over the empire. And the Jews' rebellion eventually ended in their temple mound being leveled, exactly as Jesus said, some 40 years after he uttered this prophecy. The second question that he asked, the first question number one, when shall these things be? When will this temple be leveled? He answered that in 4, 5, and 6. Question number two, what shall be the sign of thy coming? In other words, what will happen to let us know you're about to establish yourself as king of the kingdom? Well, the next thing he did was to tell them in verses 7 and 8 that there would come a time when you would notice famines, earthquakes, and pestilence increasing like a woman's birth pangs, so you could know that it was nigh, even at the doors. And those signs of the earthquakes, famines, and pestilences is what I've been showing now for a very long time to let people know that the coming of the Lord is very near. The best I can do is to tell you it's at the doors, that it's nigh, that your redemption draweth nigh. Those are Babel terms that indicate that when you see these three things begin to happen, that you can know that it's very near, and it is very near. The last question that he asked, question number 3, what shall be the sign of the end of the world? And the word he used for world is ion, which means age. They said, when are you going to pour out your wrath, or when is the Father going to pour out his wrath upon the earth? When is all this going to end? Because it had to end before his millennial reign began. So in essence, we're talking about the very end of the tribulation period when we answer this question. What they're saying is, how will you destroy the existing kingdom to end this age? Well, the first prophecy of the temple mound being leveled was fulfilled in AD 70 by Titus and the Roman legion when they came down and did exactly what Jesus predicted. The second question is being fulfilled right now. And the third question will be answered in the tribulation period. We're in the beginning of sorrows. The earthquakes, the famines, and the pestilences for the first time in history are following the pattern of a woman's birth pangs. So we're in the beginning of sorrows. So the next thing is, when is Jesus going to come and end this age of the church, known as the age of grace? When is he going to come and end the church age that he was organizing at that time, having already organized the church? We're toward the tail end of the beginning of sorrows. It's time for the Antichrist to start to phase in. The events in the Middle East give ample evidence that that is true. Now, Ehud Barak has signed an agreement with Yasser Arafat to accelerate the process of giving back the territories that were made in the Raya agreement, where they are going to give back 11% of the West Bank, 11% more, to the Palestinians, where they will have complete autonomy in those areas. And they are also going to start working very shortly on a final conclusive peace treaty, which would include such questions as, will they let the Palestinians become an independent state? I think they will. And the question of Jerusalem. I think the Israelis, I know, will never give back the city of Jerusalem, but they may let the Palestinians have a capital there over on the eastern side in what is known as Silloe, and they may jointly share the Temple Mount itself. In any case, the Antichrist, I believe, is alive and breathing right now. And I'm going to start talking about the Antichrist and going into the book of Revelation in that section. I'm also going to be dealing with the Olivet Discourse. And we're going to be talking about some things that are current and happening right now, because eventually the Antichrist is going to be revealed and worshipped in 2 Thessalonians 2, chapter 2, verses 3 through 12. But we've been dealing in the morning with the wrath of God, which is the answer to the third question. What shall be the sign of the end of the world, the age, and how will you destroy the existing kingdoms to end this age? When I talk about the end of the age, the end of the world, and the question that they ask, I'm talking about really the opening of the sixth seal. On the opening of the sixth seal, the wrath of God, a preview of coming attractions is given. And at the very last part of this sixth seal, after several different sentences describing the whole tribulation period, we're told that the wrath of God is revealed. The opening of the seven seals by Jesus, the line of Judah. So in Revelation 5:5, where we've been for so long on Sunday morning, and one of the elders saith unto me, weep not, behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, hath prevailed to open the book and to loose the seven seals thereof. This is not a new prophecy. Jesus indicated, and the Spirit of Christ, who wrote through John the book of Revelation, indicated that seven seals would be opened. On the opening of the sixth seal, he gives a preview of coming attractions of everything that's going to happen throughout the entire horrible events that are supposed to occur in the tribulation period. And it ends it by talking about the wrath of God being come. So that's what we're dealing with. The end of the age is when the wrath of God comes on this earth. I don't think it's in the too far distant future. Revelation 6:17, this is the statement in it that closes this long discourse. Remember back in Revelation 6:12, you have every island beginning to move out of its place. You have tremendous earthquakes. The sun, moon, and stars are darkened. You have men running and hiding in the dens and caves of the rock. Now, he closes this preview of coming attractions by telling you what's going to happen at the very end of the tribulation period, which is on the pouring out of the last vial. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? Now, he talks about his coming. He talks about the seventh trumpet. And the nations are angry, and thy wrath is come. This is when the wrath of God comes on the earth. It does not come on the earth until after the church has been raptured out. Till after, I should say, the saved. Not that I mean that all the saved are in the church, but all the saved are going to be raptured out, and they're going to be raptured out on the blowing of the seventh trumpet. At this time, the nations are angry. The Battle of Armageddon has not yet taken place. It is five chapters away, and that is when the actual rapture occurs. And then, after the rapture occurs, we're taken up to heaven, all the saved. We're judged there. What's going to be happening on the earth while we're being judged there? Revelation 11:18, the nations were angry and thy wrath is come. Look at the last part of this verse, the last statement in it. Well, the nations were angry and thy wrath is come, last statement, and shouldest destroy them which destroy the earth. While God is destroying the earth, not completely, but while he is wreaking havoc on it, sending down hail, fire, brimstone, terrible, unbelievable tribulation on those who were not taken out by his son on the blowing of the seventh trumpet, I want you to notice what's happening in heaven while the wrath of God is being poured out on the earth. The saved of all the ages are being judged. He says, and the nations were angry and thy wrath is come. The last phrase says, and shouldest destroy them which destroy the earth. Now look what's between these two phrases. And the time of the dead that they should be judged. This is a resurrection of all the saved dead of all the ages. And they are going to be judged. And what are they going to be judged for? As saved men and women, as children of God from all ages, what is it that they're judged for? For rewards. And the time of the day that they should be judged, thou shouldest give reward unto thy servants the prophets, and to the saints, and them that fear thy name, small and great. The Lord made sure he called everybody by that description. Thy servants the prophets, to the saints, and them that fear thy name, small and great. That includes every single category of person you could possibly include as being saved, as knowing Christ. And so either they were looking forward to his coming, believed he was the Messiah while he was here, or look back on his life and believe he is the Messiah and are looking forward to his coming. This is a judgment for rewards for the life they lived in the flesh after they trusted in the God who promised them this Messiah way back in Genesis 3:15, the promised seed. So this is the destruction of those who would not serve God, who would not believe God. And while that's going on and all hell is going on the earth, we're going to be judged in heaven. So while all this is going on earth, this is what's going to happen in heaven. Here you see the judgment seat of Christ. You see the various crowns, rewards that are mentioned. You have the rapture, which I believe occurs on the blowing of the seventh trumpet. I believe that's the last trump. I believe it's the trump of God. And I believe that all the saved are going to be caught up. Now, I don't know exactly when this is going to occur, and I realize this is a definite number I'm going to use, and it sounds very specific. But I don't know that that's true. I think it occurs about 45 days before the end. In other words, I think we're going through most of the tribulation period. And I think this is going to be something that will give us tremendous strength and encouragement when all this starts, because when all this starts, we'll know for sure that everything that God told us is absolutely true. In any case, whenever the rapture occurs, Christ meets the saved in the air. That's an absolute certainty. And then we have the judgment seat of Christ. Now, what's he going to judge us for? Well, what is the judgment for? It's for reward. And if thou shouldest give reward unto thy servants the prophets. What is the reward? It is how close you live to Christ. In Revelation 19:7, we're told, and the marriage of the Lamb, the same one whose wrath is come, and the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife hath made herself ready. Well, how did she make herself ready? Why do people drop out of church? Well, it's because they don't like the pastor. Why do people drop out of church? Well, it's because they don't like the music program. Why do people drop out of church? Because we don't have enough activities for the children. Why do people drop out of church? You can think of a multiplicity of reasons. But what is the real underlying reason that people quit coming to church? They don't love Christ. You say, well, now, Brother McElmurray, they don't love Christ. Now, I'm not talking about when somebody goes to another church and keeps worshiping God. That's a true church. I'm talking about why people quit coming to church. They don't love Christ. And I apologize for using the same illustration so much, but it's so vivid, I know it's true. When you got saved, you were espoused to Christ. That meant you had a contract with him that was you couldn't break if you wanted to. It means you were espoused to him and promised to him, and you were his. And it wasn't like an engagement. It was a legal espousement. Now, one day, with the Hebrew espousement, which Christ used quite frequently, and that's what this wife refers to, the husband came for the wife. She was already legally his wife, and he came for her. Was she anxiously awaiting it? Did she really want him to come? Did it really mean something to her? When you first met O.D., and afterwards when you fell in love with him, you just liked being with him, didn't you? And you wished he was here right now so you could be with him. Why? She loved him. And Norma, what would you do without old Charlie? You love him. You want to be where he is, continually. That's what love is. When I met Imogene, no middle initial Vaughn, I just had to be where she was. And I'd do anything on the earth to get where she was. And I just loved to be around her. I was in love with her. And I didn't want to be separated from her. These trips, Lord, I wish I could be home with her. I still love her. I love her more now than I ever loved her before in my life. And I'd love to be here with her. But we made an agreement a long time ago that we were going to put Christ first. And so she puts up with me being gone. Sometimes it's a blessing, the way I mess up the house. But in any case, why is it that people quit coming to church? They don't love Jesus Christ. You say, well, now that's a pretty bold statement. Well, it's a very true statement. Why? I bow before God, and I stand before man, and I tell you this is one of his churches. Because we teach and preach the same thing that he delivered to the first New Testament disciples and that he taught in his church in the New Testament. This is one of his churches. So I have a promise from God. He said to the church at Ephesus, he said, in whom ye also, it's plural, himaeus, you members, you parts of the body, in whom ye also are builded together, put together, for a habitation of God through the Spirit. God's Spirit is here. Christ's Spirit is here right now. And that's why people come to church that keep on coming and don't stop. They really believe that Christ is in the midst of them. And they like to be where he is. And as long as you've got a pastor and you've got teachers that teach what he says, you like to hear it because it's him speaking to you. And the reason a lot of people switch churches is because they get a pastor who very rarely ever preaches on what Christ said to people, but preaches 3 points, a poem, a cloud of dust, and hi-ho silver away. And tremendous emphasis is put on every other phase of the worship. But very little is put on the preaching of the Word of God. So I used to love to hear what Imogene had to say. And you come to church, and if the Word is preached and taught, you like being there. You love him because you like to be where he is. Well, if that's the case, how'd you like to be where he is forever? In his immediate presence. I'm not talking about going to heaven. I'm talking about what happens when you get there. At the judgment seat of Christ, he's going to make a selection. He's going to choose out of all the saved those that he believed, measured up to who he considered worthy. Why did I marry Imogene Nomidal of Initial Bond? Because she loved me. Would I have married her if she didn't love me? No. But I married her because she loved me. Those who love Jesus will be those who wanted to be where he was in a local New Testament church serving him, listening to what he had to say through the preached and taught word, studying it for themselves, and those are the ones that love him, and those are the ones he's going to pick out. What we're really talking about here is a bridal position, which is commensurate, associated with, parallel to, the New Testament church age. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Enoch and Abel and David, they'll all be in that city, but they weren't born in this dispensation of time. You were. If you want to live in that heavenly city, if you want to be chosen as his bride, be known as the bride in heaven, coming from this particular age, then you had better be faithful to God. So after the judgment, what's happened? Well, you have the marriage of the Lamb. Who's he going to pick? Those that loved him here and wanted to be where he was here. Then you're coming all the way back to earth. Then there's going to be a marriage supper of the Lamb in heaven before you come. Before you come back to earth, there's going to be marriage supper of the Lamb in heaven. There are going to be lots of people there, lots of guests. All of them ecstatically happy, joyous, rejoicing that they're at the Lamb's supper. But right here is going to be the happiest person in all of heaven. It's going to be the bride. Men don't choose a wife because she's super intelligent. At least they shouldn't. And they don't pick a wife because she's ecstatically beautiful. At least they shouldn't. They pick a wife because they know that that woman loves them and respects them and wants to live with them forever. That's how a man who has any sense picks a wife. And Jesus knows who loves him and who doesn't. The key word is endurance. It's continuing. The bridal position simply means that you'll be in the immediate proximity of where Jesus is forever. That's why I spend so much time emphasizing this millennial temple in the millennial age, the heaven age city that follows, because Jesus is going to dwell right here in the millennial temple. He's going to dwell right here in the midst of this city. How does he pick out his bride? Well, I was so madly in love with Imogene that I just couldn't stand being away from her. You don't know what a hard time I have being away from her now. Lots of times I call her and she's not there. She's hard to catch because the kids work her to death when I'm not here, and they work her to death when I am here, and then I also work her to death. But I want to be with her. I love to irritate her. She's so predictable. And I just love to irritate her. You say, that's terrible. Oh, it's just a game we play. We have a lot of fun. We're like a couple of kids, and we enjoy the games we play. But right here at the altar of Abel and Cain, God was there. Spirit of God was there. His spirit was there. He even told Cain, if you'll go present the right offering, he said it'll be acceptable. But Cain was hard-headed. He wanted to worship God his way. But Abel brought what God told him to bring. And God's spirit accepted it, and Abel loved God, and Cain did not. In the temple or tabernacle in the wilderness, the Spirit of God dwelt here, in the Holy of Holies, in this tent or tabernacle in the wilderness. The people who came offering their sacrifices to God, believing he lived there, and wanting to be closer to him and in fellowship with him, those were the people of that age that loved God. In the temple of Solomon, in the temple of Zerubbabel, the temple of Herod, those who came there believing that God's presence was there and offered their sacrifices to God, wanting to be as close to God and in fellowship with him as they could, wanting forgiveness of their sins, God honored it. Those are the people that love God. In this local New Testament church age in which we live, God has built us together as the habitation of God through the Spirit. Sister Barnes is a living block in this church. So is Alan Kennedy. So am I. So is Anna Henry. So is every one of you here that knows Christ as your Savior and has chose to unite together to worship God in spirit and in truth. We have to learn to live together. We have to learn to work together. There are certain things about each other I'm sure we don't like. I'm sure we wish we were different in certain ways, and I'm sure we wish that everything was the way we would like for it to be. But that's what a church is. Learning to love one another, even though we don't agree on everything, and learning to care for one another, and we're building together. Christ is our foundation. He's our head. Every time we come together, he's in the midst of us. You ought to want to be where Christ is. I know a lot of people put up with a lot of sorry preaching, put up with a lot of inconveniences in the church they're not too happy with, but they come and they're in that church because they believe that Jesus Christ is there, and they're there for that reason. You will never stop those people from coming to church, because they're people that are coming for the right reason, because they understand what the church is, they understand who Jesus is, and they understand the importance of loving his body. So if at the altar of Cain and Abel, God was there, if at the altar of Noah, God was there, if at the altar of Abraham, God was there, if at the altar of Jacob, the man Israel, he was there, and God called it Bethel, or Jacob called it Bethel, the house of God. And if a ladder extended down and God was at the top of it approving the sacrifice of Isaac, not of Isaac, but of Israel, the man Jacob. And if he was in the tent and in the temple and here, who do you think he's going to let live in that millennial temple? And who do you think he's going to let live in that New Jerusalem? Those people that worshiped him in the place, in the manner that he directed in the dispensation of time in which they lived. I bow before God, and I stand before man, and I tell you that's the whole reason for your life as a child of God, to worship God the way he wants to be worshiped. So many churches have the idea that unless a church is just on fire for Jesus, and they just keep adding lost souls and adding lost souls and adding lost souls, that that's all that's important. And they say, what's the matter? Don't you have a burden for the lost? How many of those lost souls do you see continue in those churches? Do you ever wonder how many of them really were saved? Do you really wonder sometimes if we aren't trying to do God's work in our own flesh and we're not leaving a lot of things up to the Spirit? Do you really believe sometimes we're shortchanging God's Spirit? Do you really believe and think that it's all that simple and easy? Brothers and sisters in Christ, I'm telling you, if Jesus had been interested with numbers, he would have ended up with a whole lot more than 120 people in his church after 3.5 years of ministry on the day of Pentecost. Well, I've been talking about the wrath of God. And the wrath of God is something that, quite frankly, is the answer to the third question that Jesus asked. And what shall be the sign of the end? We got down to right here in this verse of, in these verses of Scripture. We read Revelation 6:17 last week, then 11:18. And then we came in on Revelation 16:15-21. In Revelation 16:15, behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garment, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And I described what this meant. Immediately thereafter, and he gathered together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. So if in verse 16, he's gathering them for the final battle of Armageddon. And if I've already shown you on the blowing of the seventh trumpet, when it says, and thy wrath is come, and the time of the dead, that they should be judged, and thou shouldest give rewards unto thy servants the prophets, and to the saints, and them that fear thy name, then wouldn't it stand a reason that if in verse 16 he says he gathered them together into a place called the Hebrew tongue Armageddon, wouldn't it stand a reason in verse 15 that this is the same group of people that are being judged at the judgment seat of Christ that you found back interspiced between 11:18, the first phrases and the last phrase, and shouldest destroy them which destroy the earth? Look at verse 15 above verse 16. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked, and they see his shame. That doesn't mean naked as a peacock jaybird who you still have on a beach cloth. I described what that meant to you last Sunday morning. So why am I doing all this? We need to be alert. We need to be watching. Because when Christ comes, we need to be doing what we're supposed to be doing, where we're supposed to be doing it, in the place he directed, the local New Testament church. He warns you. He says, I come as a thief. He didn't say, I'm not going to take you to heaven. He didn't say you're going to hell if you're not living for me at that time. He said, you better keep your garments. Well, what are your garments? In Revelation 19:7, we're told, and his wife hath made herself ready. And then we're told that her garments are garments of fine linen and white. Don't tell me there aren't going to be class distinctions in heaven. You can't lose your salvation. But I guarantee you can lose your garments. You can lose your reward in heaven. You can end up in heaven and not being the bride of Christ, you can end up in heaven, and forever you'll be ecstatically happy. You'll have a glorified body. But the Bible clearly indicates there are going to be robes in heaven, different types of outer garments. Would you rather have something that lasts for 1,000 years and then forever? Or are you going to live your life down here the way you want to live it, as a saved man or woman, and yet never make a serious commitment to God to serve Him? You make the choice. God is the one who gives the reward. But you make the choice. You say, well, does this mean forever in heaven they'll walk around and everybody will be mocking them in shame and it'll be like a purgatory or a little cabin in the corner of glory land? No, he just used this as an illustration. He's telling you you're going to be a whole lot happier in heaven. And you're going to actually be known by everybody in heaven as somebody that loved Christ. And it'll be apparent, people can see it with their glorified eyes, that you were someone that loved Him. And so you'll be the one He picks if you're faithful as a wife, a spouse to a husband, according to the traditions of the Hebrew custom. And the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air. We're now in Revelation 16:17. And there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven from the throne, saying, it is done. It's finished. What's finished? The work of God. What's finished? What was the third question? What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world, the end of the age? He says, it is done. This is when Jesus comes back. This is when he takes the Antichrist and the false prophet and casts them into a lake of fire. This is when the end of the age occurs. And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, but it was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. This is the final great earthquake in the book of Revelation. We're going to stop here, and I'll probably pick up here, or I may start a whole new discourse about the end time events next Sunday morning. For 21 years, I've been to churches all over this country and all over the world, in fact. And I've talked about these end-time events. What's happening in Israel right now is the most significant thing that has occurred in a long period of time. Once the Palestinians make a lasting peace with Israel, then Syria is not far behind. And you better look out, because when Syria gets into the picture, when they sign that peace treaty, it's all over. There are things happening right now, happened over the weekend in Israel, that are extremely significant. Some things I've waited for a very long time. They're here. They're happening. They're going to continue to happen. And quite frankly, I've never been so excited in my life about the coming of the Lord, because, quite frankly, everything is falling into place, and we don't have long to wait. I thank God that when this last great earthquake occurs, and all the cities, plural, and all the nations, plural, of the earth, and the great city of Jerusalem is divided into three parts, and the city of Babylon, Rome, is destroyed. I thank God I won't be on this earth. I'll be in heaven with the Lord. And when he comes back and he takes the Antichrist and the false prophet and puts them in a lake of fire, I'll be with him. And I want to live where he lives, and I want to be used of him. And I think the only way a man can show, or a woman can show, their love for Christ is to be where his body is located on this earth. And the church is his body. You need to be faithful and true to it. And if people had more confidence in God's Holy Spirit, they'd cut out a lot of this hyper-evangelism. They'd see more genuine professions of faith. And people could see that this is real and not some imaginary thing with a lot of trumpets and horns and strange-sounding cymbals. So that's it for this morning. And Lord willing, we'll pick up here next Sunday.